This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Before Tom Young became a novelist, he worked as a writer and editor at the Associated Press, also spent time flying commercial airplanes, and served in the Air National Guard. During Tom's service, he did tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's been on missions in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Latin America. And it was after all of that that he decided to pursue a lifelong dream of writing fiction. His first novel was The Mullah's Storm, a military adventure that introduced two characters Tom Young is still writing about today, Air National Guard Lieutenant Colonel Michael Parson and his fellow soldier Sophia Gold. Parson and Gold are back in Tom's newest book, The Hunters, which has them at odds with an al-Shabaab leader at the Horn of Africa. Tom's going to be reading from The Hunters at Durham's Regulator Bookshop Saturday, July 18th. And he is joining us here now on The State of Things. Tom Young, welcome.
Good afternoon, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Where did Colonel Michael Parson come from?
Colonel Parson is a composite of people I've known in the military. I can't point to any one person and say, that's Parson. But he's a composite of some of the people I served with. I made some great friends in the military, and I hope my characters do justice to the real-world people that I knew in the Air National Guard and the Air Force.
How about Sophia Gold? Same thing?
Same with her. Again, I can't point to any one character and say that's Sophia Gold, but she was inspired by a lot of the female military members with whom I served. I never served with anyone who was interpreter translator the way Sophia is, but I flew with a lot of female crew members with whom I had a lot of respect, and parts of them became Sophia Gold.
For people who are not familiar with your books, maybe you can give us a little character sketch of each of these characters.
Michael Parson is an Air Force flyer. He made his first appearance in my first novel, The Mullah's Storm, as a C-130 navigator. In later books, he cross-trains, becomes a C-5 pilot, and As the novels go on from book one to book six, he climbs in rank. He grows in responsibility. In one of my novels, The Renegades, he's an advisor to the Afghan Air Force. In another of my novels, Sand and Fire, he's an expeditionary air wing commander. And now in The Hunters, he's kind of come back to basics. He's sort of at the tip of the spear again, but he's on a civilian humanitarian relief mission in Somalia.
And what about Sophia Gold?
She starts out as an interpreter-translator. She speaks Pashto. And in the first two or three novels, she's an Army NCO. She leaves the Army to work for the United Nations, but she keeps in touch with Parson, and she keeps finding ways to work with him on various adventures around the world.
As you say, this mission is a humanitarian mission, and as they say, no good deed goes unpunished. And sure enough, Colonel Parson is punished by al-Shabaab, of all. So tell us about now the conflict.
Yes. In The Hunters, my primary bad guy, my primary villain, is a 14-year-old Somali gunman named Hussein. But he's something of, I'd almost say he's a sympathetic villain. The Somali terrorist group al-Shabaab picked him up as an orphan on the streets of Mogadishu, and he's turned to al-Shabaab because he has nowhere else to look for help. He's illiterate, he's never been to school, and all he knows is what terrorist leaders tell him. But despite Hussein's illiteracy, he has a spark of intelligence. He's a little bit smarter than some of the other boys around him. And in fact, he's self-aware enough to know what a weakness it is that he can't read. He realizes that it places him in a vulnerable position if he can only believe what a terrorist leader tells him. If someone says to him, you need to go do these things because the Quran says so, he has no way to confirm that. But still, he's a bad guy. He's committed to the path of what he sees as jihad. In fact, early in the book, his highest ambition is to learn to read just so he can read the Quran and lead the jihad. Eventually, he and his al-Shabaab comrades set out to kill or capture my two main recurring characters, Parson and Gold. In the process of doing that, Hussein gets hurt. He sustains a serious injury, and Parson and Gold find him in this wounded, vulnerable state. Well, because of their moral code, because he's a child, because of the laws of armed conflict, they can't do the easiest thing. They can't just shoot him and press on. They feel obligated to bind his wounds, to give him first aid, and even to take him in while they themselves are on the run and hiding from his al-Shabaab comrades. And this experience rocks Hussein's world because he finds that he's not getting treated the way he was told he would be treated if infidels ever captured him. And because he's wounded, he's face to face with what he sees as his sworn enemies. But he can't do anything about it. He can't lash out. He can only sit and listen and observe. And the listening is aided by translation from Parsons' Somali-American flight mechanic named Gidi. And Hussein begins to see, hey, the only difference between myself and Gidi is Gidi got a long airplane ride to the States when he was little. That could be me. And he begins to question everything he's been taught. He begins to ask himself whether Allah really demands all this killing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating insight into the power of ideology, any ideology, whatever your belief is, a belief system that is so rigid that it can't allow for the sense of vulnerability and an opening to what somebody told you, or who somebody told you was your enemy.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
It's a kind of an ingenious way to sort of get at that question. Can I get you to read for us?
Yes, absolutely. I'll read from the first few paragraphs of the first chapter, and let's see. In this segment, we see Hussein before he's met Parson and Gold, and this segment sets up his worldview and the way he sees things before he ever meets my two main recurring characters. Hunger, rage. 14-year-old Hussein felt little else as he rode in the back of a Nissan pickup truck along a dirt road south of Mogadishu. Five fellow Al-Shabaab fighters traveled with him in the truck bed. One manned a cord 12.7-millimeter machine gun bolted near the tailgate, and the rest brandished AK-47s. Hussein's entire worldly possessions consisted of his AK, his sandals, a dirty cotton shirt and trousers, and a machete hanging from a rope belt and a leather sheath. For a promised piece of fruit every day, Hussein had become a soldier of God. The older men had yet to give him his daily tangerine. Rewards would come later if he and his brothers in jihad performed this mission well. Along with the fruit, he hoped to get a bowl of onion and potato soup, just like yesterday and the day before that. His mouth still watered when he remembered that day last week when the men fed him fried goat meat. Such feasts came rarely for the young soldiers of God. Al-Shabaab, or the youth, faced many hardships inflicted by the infidels. These gallows, these unbelieving foreigners, brought hunger, the death of parents and friends, and so-called medicine that only made diseases worse. But today, the unbelievers would feel God's wrath. The truck slowed and stopped at a crossroads. Dust kicked up by the Nissan's tires rolled in clouds and stung Hussein's eyes. Thorn scrub littered the dunes that stretched from the crossroads to the beach. Beyond the beach, the Indian Ocean sparkled blue to the horizon. Seagulls wheeled over the surf. The new boss got out of the passenger side of the pickup. Hussein knew him only as the Sheikh, a man who spoke of many things Hussein did not understand. But the Sheikh led the struggle now, and God gave him his words just as the angels had bidden Muhammad to recite the holy book. "Out of the truck, my pups," the Sheikh said. Hussein and four of his comrades scrambled over the tailgate and hopped to the ground. One stayed behind to man the machine gun. The driver got out of the truck and stood beside the Sheikh. Hussein knew the driver as Abdullahi. Abdullahi would beat you for laziness or for grabbing at food. He wore a black kerchief around his head and neck, which left only his eyes visible. The Sheikh wore plain clothes like Hussein and mirrored sunglasses. Another Al-Shabaab truck arrived, carrying only the driver. The driver remained inside and kept the engine idling. "A nest of vipers has installed itself in Mogadishu," the Sheikh said. He gestured with his right hand, index finger extended, as he often did during his sermons. "They dare to call themselves a legitimate government with their sham elections and unclean money from the Americans and the British and the United Nations. The only legitimate government is that of God, of the Islamic Emirate of Somalia." At the mention of the Islamic Emirate, the fighters cheered. Hussein cheered with them, raised his weapon high into the air.
Tom Young, reading from his new novel, The Hunters. He's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Saturday and at the Richard H. Thornton Library in Oxford on Sunday, July 26th, with me here on The State of Things. You know, it's interesting because your characters, your Parson and Gold have evolved too. Did they evolve from more sort of ideologically driven soldiers to sort of more open-minded soldiers through their career? Do you think there's something of that in their evolution in your novels?
Parson certainly did, with Gold's help. In my first novel, The Mullah's Storm, he loses some of his closest friends early in the war in Afghanistan. And he has a lot of anger to work through. Oh, by the way, while he and Gold are on the run for their lives. And his anger feeds his prejudices. He in the beginning, he hates all Muslims. And Gold helps him work through that.
What about you as a writer? Clearly, writing had been interesting to you. Had you always felt that you were a novelist? Or when did this urge emerge in you?
I had always wanted to be a novelist. I have a civilian career in journalism, but I'd always wanted to write fiction. Going all the way back to college, I went through the creative writing program at UNC. And I wrote the occasional short story and travel piece and so forth. But I never came up with a novel plot that I could really sink my teeth into until I got deployed for the war in Afghanistan. I once heard someone say, your best fiction comes from what hurts you the most or what scares you the most. Well, when my crewmates and I first started flying airlift missions in Afghanistan, what scared me the most was not the thought of getting shot down and killed. It was the thought of getting shot down and not killed. What would you face in a survival situation on the ground? And, oh, by the way, what if that happened in the midst of a strong winter storm that made a helicopter rescue impossible? Oh, and by the way, what if you'd been transporting a high-value Taliban detainee who wants very much for you to get caught? That became the plot to my first novel, The Mullah's Storm.
Did you find you went through that checklist of you know, sort of increasing terror pretty easily just now? Was that harder for you to do? Did you find those doors simply wouldn't open? The next level of fear was something you really had to shake at and break down? Or did one sort of naturally lead to the next level of fear?
It took me a while to understand that to write a good novel, especially in this genre, you need tension on every page, beginning with the first word. And the best way to do that is to find a bad situation for your characters and then find a way to make it worse. Or as I once heard someone say, put your characters up a tree and then throw rocks at them.
Did you imagine how they would evolve from the first novel, or did they sort of walk you through that?
The characters walked me through that. The characters really did tell me what they wanted to do. And I know that sounds strange, but there really is something to this concept of the muse. Sometimes it almost seems like it's coming from somewhere else and it's not even mine. But when I wrote the first novel, I had no idea there would ever be a sequel, let alone five sequels. Mm-hmm. And I didn't outline at all. I literally made it up as I went along and let the characters tell me what they wanted to do. And it just sort of flowed naturally.
Do you take also, you were a journalist and did that kind of writing. Does that sometimes get in the way? I just wonder if anybody's had experience as a journalist, if sometimes that experience gets in the way of, you know, letting the facts get in the way of a good story.
I won't say it got in the way, but it took me only so far. When I first started trying to write fiction, I had this attitude, hey, I used to write for the Associated Press. The world should be the path to my door now that I want to be a novelist. But that's not exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Writing in journalism teaches you how to write a good sentence. It gives you the tools, but that's just a hammer and nail. Then you have to learn how to build a house with those hammer and nails. You have to understand that with a novel, you're doing so much more than reporting what happened. You're getting into motivation, you're getting into conflict and that sort of thing. And it took me a long time to learn that.
Do you ever think you want to sort of work it now the other way, go back as a journalist with your novelist instinct and see how you would report a story? Again, giving with that kind of depth and context and with the questions that you as a novelist would ask, that maybe a reporter would feel were irrelevant for their story. Would it change? Is that an interesting prospect for you?
It is. It is. I've not had the opportunity to step back into journalism very often, except for the occasional op-ed piece and so forth. But for example, if I had an opportunity to report from overseas now, I would certainly do it from a vastly different perspective, having written about these conflicts as a novelist, and then having experience them as a military member.
Is the next one in the works?
The next one is a little bit different. I'm working on a historical novel set in World War II.
Wow, so we won't see these characters in your next novel.
At least not in the next novel. I'll never say never, but not in the next novel.
Can you tell us more about it? What's going to happen?
Well, it's a novel that involves two main characters that normally would never meet. One is a B-17 pilot from a German-American family in Pennsylvania. This pilot's father immigrated from Germany. They spoke German in the household. The other main character is a German U-boat executive officer. My pilot gets shot down over Germany on what was to have been his last mission. He survives the shootdown, and now he has to evade capture in Germany. My U-boat crewman, as he's coming back into base from a long, hard patrol near the end of the war, receives what amounts to a suicide order, an order that says, on your next patrol, when your torpedoes are expended, attack Allied shipping by ramming. Well, he sees where this is going, and he sees no need to sacrifice his crew for what has become a lost cause, so he decides to desert. And as he deserts, and as my American pilot evades capture, these two run into each other.
We'll have you back when that one's out.
Terrific. Thank you.
Tom Young, acclaimed author of the Parson and Gold Military Adventures series, the most recent novel, The Hunters. You can catch Tom Young reading from the novel at Durham's Regulator Books Saturday, July 18th. That's at 7 o'clock. And then at the Richard H. Thornton Library in Oxford, Sunday on the 26th at 2 o'clock. Check out our website if you didn't get that, stateofthings.org. We've got all the information there. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.